I want to this week talk a little bit about two chapters, but before we dive in, let's pray, and then I'm going to read a portion of 1 Corinthians 13. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. We thank you, Lord, for bringing us here safely to this new day, in this warm and inviting place, this safe place where we can reflect together on the life and witness of Dr. King, his teachings, his example, his inspiration. May it be more than words and more than history. May it move us in our own lives today. May we take what we hear and ponder this day and find ways through the power of your Spirit to manifest it. And all this we pray in Jesus' name.
Amen.
The Apostle Paul writes these immortal words in 1 Corinthians 13, which we have heard how many countless times at how many countless weddings, not written about marriage at all, not written for or about that even in the slightest, written for the purpose of inspiring a deeply conflicted community in Corinth. If you read either of the letters of Paul to the Corinthians, and we think they're actually smooshed together multiple letters of Paul to the Corinthians, and in history they just took them and lumped a bunch of them together, you see that the Corinthians were a hot mess, and Paul was writing them all the time because they needed to be led and taught. And so we get all this wonderful language of challenge and frustration by Paul. Paul was always so exasperated at the Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians 12, we have the language about many members, one body. And then in 1 Corinthians 13, the very next part is this thing that we always hear in weddings, but has absolutely very little to do with weddings, although it certainly speaks across context. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. I want you to hold on to that as we reflect today on Dr. King's writing and speaking after the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Acts, in the wake of those, and as he made a significant pivot in his life and witness and example from addressing the deeply systemic and racially unjust practices of our society to seeing how they address and are applied to a much broader global context. Did you have a chance to read either of these chapters? Because they are, I would say, especially Chaos or Community, that last chapter in Chaos or Community written in 1967. The introduction to Cornel West's edition acknowledges just how hard he worked on this volume. He was really deeply wrestling with what he wanted to be about, what he wanted to say, and what this meant, how he would use his voice and crystallize and synthesize lots of different ideas and things that were happening, of course, Vietnam, but also crippling injustice around economics, national economics, and then looking more broadly at the world and seeing that the movement for racial justice in the United States is only part of a broad, much larger movement. I think it is one of his most profound, concise, important pieces of writing and witness. If you haven't read it, chapter 6 is very much worth your time, and you will see essentially a boiled down version of everything his life was about. He begins by Well, he's a preacher, so he begins so brilliantly. And I think that this particular chapter at the end of Chaos or Community, which you should read all of, if you've never read the whole thing, you should read all of Chaos or Community, but this particular last chapter, he has all these wonderful rhetorical flourishes, because, of course, he is he's a public orator first, so he has ways of using speech concisely and poignantly and poetically, and those turns of phrase are so wonderful. But he begins with an illustration about a novelist whose papers left behind a suggestion for a novel. A widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. That sounds like a great novel. And then he says, that's America. That's the world right now. A widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. It's his sort of profound metaphor for what it means to live, to inhabit that time 50 years ago, still remarkably accurate. It is much like Paul's letters to the divided, conflicted church in Corinth, which speak 2,000 years later. I feel like this continues to resonate today, as do his metaphors, as do his illustrations. He talks about how we are advancing scientifically at a dizzying speed, but we have not yet answered the question how we are going to live together. He acknowledges all of the sort of transformational, global transformational events. I mean, this is the decade of the space race. I mean, just in a single generation, essentially one single generation, the transformation of transportation, communication. Remarkable advancements, and he says, that we haven't still learned how to live together. And this refrain, he writes later, together we must learn to live as brothers, or together we will be forced to perish as fools. Which is why we fight for equality domestically and yet cannot shirk the fight for justice and dignity around the world. He writes, in one sense, the civil rights movement in the United States is a special American phenomenon which must be understood in the light of American history and dealt with in terms of the American situation. But on another and more important level, what is happening in the United States today is a significant part of a world development. The deep rumbling of discontent that we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. It is not only beautiful as a piece of writing, it is profound in its truth and scope today. He then connects, of course, makes a beautiful rhetorical connection on page 78 between the Exodus. I mean, if you've ever sort of wanted a concise understanding of why it is that the story of the Exodus has meant so much to the civil rights movement and down for the particular African-American population of America and more broadly and justice movements more globally, this is it. In one paragraph, he does all the work. The Bible tells the thrilling story of how Moses stood in Pharaoh's court centuries ago and cried, "Let my people go." This was an opening chapter and a continuing story. The present struggle in the United States is the later chapter in the same story. Something within has reminded the Negro of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Consciously or unconsciously, he has been caught up by the spirit of the times, and with his black brothers in Africa and his brown and yellow brothers in Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. I wonder where you are in this. What have you pondered when you read this, when you hear these words? What are you thinking about? What are you thinking about today? I mean, there is timelessness to this. So what sparks for you?
What sparks for me is having graduated from high school in a very small town in Mississippi, the heart of the Delta, and all that happened, and I won't bore you with how profound it had on my life. But what it really is saying, and what I heard over and over again, is they want it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, they've been waiting hundreds of years. When is now for us?
Indeed.
And I'm going, okay, folks, when is now?
Yeah. When is now?
And it really hurts that it takes so long to...
Yeah.
I read something in the paper this morning that said sometimes, and it's about the Methodist decision, and she said, sometimes I just want to take my fist and hit my whole culture in the throat.
He ends to this very point, what Sherry's talking about, the sort of like, how long will we wait? And now is now. I mean, like the desire, the hope is for now. And he ends with that profoundly beautiful rhetorical flourish at the end of this chapter. We are faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted by the fierce urgency of now. If you ever wondered where that comes from. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at the flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. And over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Fierce urgency of now, and yet it still feels fiercely urgent today. Remarkably urgent today. Showing the range of his considerations. I mean, he really poured a tremendous amount of time and effort into this. He was thinking not only of particular situations and crises of justice, he was thinking about lots where these concepts intersect all manner of things. I loved his almost what could be considered a kind of a throwaway little bit where he talks about the labor-saving devices. Do you remember that little bit? I just loved that. I couldn't help but sort of feel like, gosh, that was written for today. But he's talking about the sort of scientific, the rapidity of scientific advance, and how all these things that we've invented to, quote, save time, have actually made us deeply unhappy. And, you know, occasionally you can find quotes like that from different moral and philosophical leaders, like from hundreds of years ago. So this sort of feeling like our technology today in 2019 continues to sort of make promises that it can't actually fulfill, that it makes us even busier and more unhappy than ever before, even as it sort of promises like instantaneous gratification and communication. But he writes about this, and I just thought that was just such an amazing acknowledgement by Dr. King in 1967. Did I see your hand? Yes, please.
What struck me was about that other line was, you know, modern technology that's going to give all these people extra leisure time. So here's what we should do with our leisure time to fight for injustice. We kind of moved in this way. But then I was thinking to myself, and I'm like, yeah, he's too much of an optimist to realize that those same devices would continue to be part of what oppresses these same people.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we talk a lot about, you know, automation is driving out jobs.
Yeah.
Leading to more of the systemic economic injustices that he goes on to talk about. And that was kind of one of the things that really struck me was, like, you know, it's kind of like I knew that he had talked about these things. But, you know, I'm a millennial and I graduated right into the recession and child of the recession kind of thing. And it struck me as being profoundly sad that we are still having these same conversations that he was having after all those years ago.
I love this line. It is so Dr. King. It's just wonderful. Page 80. When scientific power outruns moral power, we end up with guided missiles and misguided men.
Yes.
That, as they say, will preach. We end up with guided missiles and misguided men. And, I mean, gosh, is that not accurate for 2019 too? Yes, please.
Technology is as a society in a much broader way too, in that it isolates us. So we as a group, we associate with other whites,
mm-hmm.
but we don't associate with all the other ethnic groups.
Sure.
And without associating with the others and working side by side, we can't really get a good feel
of
what they are. So we rely on the news reports to come up with an idea of what the other people are like.
Yeah.
And the news reports tend to be the spectacular and generally the negative aspects of those groups.
Sensational.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that makes it so that if someone comes up with a statement, even if it's a false statement about that group, you're much more likely to believe it than not.
Yeah.
So it makes it a lot harder to actually form good tight bonds.
It has to have that shadow side. It promised, I mean, of course, contemporary social technology, social media, has promised the assistance of communication, the sort of support of communication, but it has had the shadow side of keeping us in silos, cultural, ethnic, economic silos, because we communicate most often with the people who are already our friends, and we don't broaden our horizons. Yeah, we do. We get in these echo chambers. Anyway, as we sit on the doorstep of Lent, I thought that this thing that's not really, I mean, it's a tangential point he's making. I thought it had a lot to say to us as we are at the doorstep of Lent, of considering how our labor-saving devices, how our use of technology is actually impeding us, potentially, from the sort of a deeper self-reflective moral questioning that we need to do about what is making us into better people. How are we having our own personal moral maturation run parallel with the technology that is enabling all of our ease and comfort? And Lent is a great time to sort of reflect if it's not, and what needs to change. I was struck again by this bit about Rip Van Winkle. Do you remember that part where he reflects on that? So wonderful. He uses again this remarkable, wonderful metaphor, this piece of great American classic fiction, to then teach a deeper lesson. He talks about the sort of interesting part of the story is not necessarily that Rip Van Winkle wakes up or that he slept for 20 years. How funny, what an interesting piece of fiction that is. But what it was when he looks at the sign hanging over, and it's no longer King George and now it's George Washington, and he says he slept through a revolution. And then, as he does so poignantly, Dr. King as a preacher, he draws that thread right through and asks the question of us: in what ways are we sleeping through a revolution? In what ways are we Rip Van Winkle, perhaps not asleep under a tree, but sleeping no less under the, throughout the revolution? One of the great liabilities of history, he writes, is that all too many people fail to remain awake through great periods of social change. But today our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and to face the challenge of change. I was just at a conference last week called the Consortium of Endowed Episcopal Parishes, which is literally the most pretentious thing you could ever name something. And essentially, it's a gathering of churches of any numerical size of the congregation. You can actually attend now. They've opened it up. You can attend the conference whether you have an endowment or not. But it's churches of any size that have an endowment and therefore are contemplating with financial questions. But then once they built this conference over a decade ago, they started to think they need to take advantage of the gathering and do other types of leadership training, formation stuff, thinking about all sorts of practices. This year's keynote, this year's plenary speaker, is a woman named Christina Cleveland, who's on the faculty of Duke Divinity School. She's a social psychologist by training, by her education and scholarship, but she's actually on the faculty of Duke Divinity, which is a wonderful sort of acknowledgement of the need to broaden contemporary theological education outside of just textbooks and think about contemporary society. Her particular area of scholarship is around race and reconciliation and white supremacy. So she is African American, and she is writing and studying as a social scientist, not just anecdotal evidence, but drilling down scientifically on, conducting and participating in studies, and then analyzing the data that are spit out by studies to come up with concise bits of information to inform leaders. And she writes that there is a, or she spoke to us, she had this room full of rectors and deans, there's about 100 of us, and we are sort of like the ultimate room full of white, old white male guys, it's just like, who've been around forever, and we're sitting there, and she spoke quite directly, provocatively, and importantly for us, to what she characterizes as the continuum of evolution, of personal evolution about I would say white moral development, understanding by white Americans of privilege and racial realities. And she said to us that there's essentially six stages in this, starting from square one, which she characterizes as coma. Being in coma. And she says, and I think it was a bit hyperbolic, I didn't have time to ask her about it. She says 99% of America is in coma. Coma is the willful state of oblivion as to the true realities of racial relationships, white supremacy and white privilege, the nature of these things as they affect day-to-day life, and that 99% of America, essentially, is in coma. Doesn't want to know, willful oblivion, isn't thinking about it, thinks that we handled all this stuff in the 1960s. Why can't we all just get on? Why are we talking about this? Didn't we solve this? And by talking about it, aren't you making it worse? So coma is both willful willfully oblivious or actively resistant and hostile. She says the second stage is puke. These are her words. When you exit coma and you start to realize that there are deeply unjust systems, and you realize the potential ways in which you have participated in them or benefited from them, and it makes you sick, and you start to, in her word, in her metaphor, puke. You start to, you just don't know what to do. You just sort of convulse with this sort of energy, and you can't believe it, and you want to, you kind of want to talk about it all the time, and you want to talk to everybody. And I'll get to the continuum of puke in just a minute, because it's the fourth stage. She says most people after puke then go into what she characterizes as trance. Trance is you have been exposed to information or stories that have challenged coma, that have challenged you to think critically about your participation in an injustice, but you have now chosen to go back to sleep. She says that most people who get through into puke go into trance because it's too hard.
It's exhausting.
It's exhausting. The dinner table conversations with your family either are devastatingly hard and you feel like you're being forced to choose between, say, family members who resent you, or a new understanding that is more truthful of the world. And most people, she says, according to her studies, choose to go back to sleep. Trance. Choose trance. She says some people exit out of trance and get into blitz, which is, I don't know, maybe this, and when she was talking about it, I'm like, maybe that's where I am. Because she says, wherever you think you are in this continuum, and she's looking at this room full of mostly white rectors and deans, and she's like, all y'all, wherever you think you are, subtract two levels, and that's actually where you are, which I thought was awesome, because we all want to think that we're like completely woke, and it's like everybody thinks they're woke. So blitz is when you get to the stage where now you want to do something, and so you're just like going around doing everything, and it's actually about your own emotional and spiritual guilt more than it is about actually rectifying the systems. But I was so struck by the way that she talks about how 99% of Americans are in coma, and those who make it out of coma, most of them go into trance because they saw a glimpse of what it is going to cost them and they go back to sleep. And here we have Dr. King saying, one of the great liabilities of history is that all too many people fail to remain awake through great periods of social change. Today, our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and to face the challenge of change.
Do you have a phrase for that?
I'm sorry? Yes. 78 to 79. The bottom of 78 to the top of 79.
Okay, and about the Rebbe
and Michael? Yeah, it's right before it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
After blitz is a fifth stage, and I forgot to jot down the description of it. It's the sort of coming down from the manic high, and then the final stage is awakening, where it is understanding your place within structures, understanding your responsibility to be an advocate for change, but also not just being manic.
That realization that you can't do it by yourself.
It's that, as Cherry just said, it's the realization that you're not going to do it by yourself, that you are a participant in this broader structure. Yes. All right. Any thoughts about that? I just tossed out, I mean, she spent an hour and a half talking to us about it and letting us engage with her about it. I wonder what thoughts you have about it. I can't direct you. Her book hasn't come out yet. She's written a different book, Christina Cleveland, and this new book that's going to talk about these stages of sort of moral and racial development is supposed to be coming out later, and I will share that then. Any thoughts about this being asleep, being awake thing from Dr. King?
What was the reaction of your peers?
Oh, I mean, everybody thinks that they're like...
Stage seven, yeah.
We're at the end. And it was important for her to say, wherever you think you are, subtract two. And, it makes you think, like, where am I? And there was a lot of self-reflection by that group of when we have tranced.
I would imagine... just knowing my own self.
Yeah.
That I sort of slip back and forth.
Indeed.
Various times of my life.
Yes. Well said. Cherry talks about how we might not be permanently in any one of the stage, but we might migrate up and down this depending. And she would totally agree with you.
What, you know, it's in the letter from Birmingham Jail, he made a point of privileged groups seldom give up their rights voluntarily.
Indeed.
And the other point he made was the word wait means never.
Yeah. Privileged groups seldom give up their privilege voluntarily, he writes from the letter in the letter from a Birmingham jail. Yeah. Yes?
I see a lot of parallels between what you're talking about, like sleeping through a revelation, and, you know, you have to stay awake to that and not sleep through a revelation. I see a lot of parallels between that and the Black Lives Matter movement and the way, because a lot of the groups there did the nonviolent protests, like in the streets, you know, join arms or, you know, and they would go through trainings of, you know, whenever police confront you, don't, you know, don't react, don't violently react, because that will screw up what we're doing. And kind of that whole stay woke thing came about through that movement. And so I see a lot of parallels, kind of like, I'm sure they intentionally went back and kind of reflecting through, you know, nonviolent resistance and what worked back then. And, you know, that's kind of the, you know, stay awake and revolution and stay woke with the Black Lives Matter movement. I see a lot of parallels there.
Yep. Thank you. I want to move on, unless... Yes, please, Joan.
I would like to refer the class to a book, White Fragility.
Yes.
Yeah.
By Robin DiAngelo. And her theme is that innocence, white population, claim innocence.
Yeah.
Because they didn't participate.
Sure.
Because they didn't know about
it. Yeah.
And they're not responsible.
Yeah. Sure. Yep. White Fragility. I have not yet read it, but I do know of it. It's a great recommendation. Keeping in mind all of this in the backdrop, and he comes to it at the end of this piece, is this 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing. It rejoices in the truth. It believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Keep that tucked away. He goes into talking about the need of this of our society to address its decaying moral foundation. It's more, I would say, it's not doomsday in the sort of eschatological sense, but it's doomsday in the, we are headed very much in the wrong direction, and these are the, this is how it is made manifest. Our failure to properly address systemic racism continues to be the source of the nation's greatest problems. And that's true 50 years later. When you look at some of the most sort of like intractable problems that we face around issues of poverty and mass incarceration, access to education. I'm sorry?
Voting.
Access to proper representation. Access to social services like clean drinking water. They are still sort of connected to the flashpoints of race and the lack of a true national reckoning around these issues. But then he takes it and he ramps out this and starts to talk about what. So instead of just naming problems, what do we do? And this is where it's really remarkable in how he spent, and Rich pointed out, keeping in mind, as I know you already know this, but just how crazy it is, that he's in his mid-30s when he's writing all this. He's dead before 40. I just think that's incredible that he had this ability to sort of move from an awareness of the ways that this is about race to include and draw into it leadership, moral leadership around poverty. And he starts to talk about this here, and we're going to read more about it in later chapters, in later classes. But he talks about how a time has come for an all-out war against poverty, because a great nation, he writes, is a compassionate nation. And he writes, and I've quoted this in a previous sermon, one day the whole Jericho road must be transformed so that men and women will not be beaten and robbed as they make their journey through life. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. True compassion understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. We do a fair amount as a society and as a church, let's just speak about church, of coin flinging. And we need to do more understanding of restructuring of unjust places. He talks about a need for a great program to fund the end of desperate poverty domestically and internationally. And he talks about the need to turn from a self-preservation attitude to what he calls other preservation. Where is that? From time immemorial, page 86, men have lived by the principle that self-preservation is the first law of life. But this is a false assumption. I would say that other preservation is the first law of life. It is the first law of life precisely because we cannot preserve self without being concerned about preserving other selves. He talks about that. John has brought us back helpfully to the letter from a Birmingham jail. Do you remember at the beginning when he's writing to all those white religious leaders and he's like, y'all want to know why I came here from Atlanta? And he talks about any time that there is an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This is just the expansion of that principle.
It's so biblical.
It is.
The least of these are brethren.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. We are our brother's keeper, he writes, because we are our brother's brother. I just think that's so wonderful. And then he ends by talking about the need to pursue peace by waging peace. That history shows that nations that pursue peace by dominating other nations and peoples are destined for falling. One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek by a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. So you don't, peace isn't something you like fight for and destroy other nations and then you sit back and enjoy peace. Peace is the vessel through which you attain peace. Say one of the theologies of the cross, and you're going to get a little taste of some theological writing from James Cone, and I've posted it to the Realm site. So I put the syllabus up on and shared it. If you access email, hopefully you'll see it. If you get on Realm, you're going to see the syllabus, but you're also going to see a link to an article and a chapter of a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree by a theologian who died last year named James Cone. And it starts to draw out what it means for Jesus on the cross to enact salvation nonviolently. That if God had used force to create the pathway for salvation, it just keeps the wheel spinning of force. And that the only way that the wheel stops spinning is if you just put something right in it to stop it, the cog of violence and retribution. The way you attain peace is through peaceful means. I loved that metaphor of Orpheus at the end of the chapter, which was so wonderful. We need to be offering, he says, we need to offer the world a different song, because the siren song is poisoning our ears and luring us to the rocks. We need to offer, instead of just like doing this, la 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 la, we need to be singing a different song, and it's a song of peace. All right. We've just got a couple minutes left, so I want to play this clip, because we didn't have a chance to talk about chapter 16, which is a speech he gave to the SCLC right around that time, talking more specifically about specific programs that they were about in Chicago and Cleveland. But at the end, he has this awesome, like, rousing, and in the written word, you don't get it. So I want to play it for you.
You will let me be a preacher just a little bit. One day. To Jesus. He wanted to know what he could do to be saved. Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do. Jesus didn't say, now Nicodemus, you must stop lying. He didn't say, Nicodemus, now you must not commit adultery. He didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must stop cheating if you're doing that. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must stop drinking liquor if you're doing that excessively. He said something altogether different because Jesus realized something basic. That if a man will lie, he will steal. And if a man will steal, he will kill. So instead of just getting bogged down on one thing, Jesus looked at it and said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. In other words, your whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will theify them and make them things. And therefore, they will exploit them and poor people generally, economically. And a nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. All of these problems are tied together. What I'm saying today is that we must go from this convention and say, America, you must be born again. So I conclude by saying today that we have a task, and let us go out with a divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until we live on the outskirts of hope, are brought into the metropolis of daily security. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history, and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not on the basis of the color of their skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied until from every city hall justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. Man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied. And men will recognize that out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth.
All right, friends, we have run out of time. We will meet next week. Next week we are talking about chapter 3. We're going back in one chapter in a sense. Chapter 3 and chapter 13. One chapter from Stride Toward Freedom and one chapter from A Trumpet of Conscience. It's his connections. It's laying out his connections between racial and economic justice. I look forward to seeing you then. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Thanks be to God.